Okay, we're back with Preston Nichols for to continue our discussion about Al Bielek and the Montauk Project. Okay, where were we?
I don't remember.
I think we were at your experience or your role with Al Bielek.
Right.
And
that's right.
That's where we were.
We're talking about the Montauk Boys. And
right, but specifically, let's focus on what did you do with Al Bielek? You said you interfaced with him in a teaching mode to some degree.
Well, we had two highly psychic things that I was involved with.
Okay.
The Montauk chair, which was the input network to the big mind amplifier, was essentially a device that used subtle quantum fields to read a person's thoughts. And he was involved from the psychic end of how, to get the Montauk chair to work. Then the Montauk chair, that was a big lounge chair that a psychic would be put in. He would be in trance, and his whole mind would concentrate on one thing. And then we had a group of coils and sensors that would pick the emanations up and put it through a bank of radio receivers, very sophisticated, old-style radio receivers designed by none other than Nikola Tesla, reportedly. And from there, digitized and put into a computer, and the computer decoded, essentially a channelized wideband information, what the person was thinking about.
So what you're saying is turning thought into reality.
Turning thought into code, basically.
Into code?
Turning thought into computer code. Huh. Then, of course, from there, it went through other computers and then into big old radar transmitters, and then turning thought into reality at that point.
So was it through this chair that people could travel to other planets and other places?
Well, the chair would be used to pick up the frequency transform that would be used to open the vortex. And people would actually enter the vortex once it was opened.
So
it didn't go through the chair to other places. Although a depth such as Duncan Cameron could lay in the chair, and he could go to other places psychically, mentally, and the chair had the capability of displaying what he was seeing, when he traveled to other places in space and time. But also it was used to pick up the frequencies for the vortex function. And went into the particle accelerator and the delta T antenna to form the time vortex.
Wow, so this is fascinating. So let's just say Duncan's sitting there on the chair,
mm-hmm.
and he does his thing. It opens up a vortex.
Mm-hmm.
When that vortex was open, would other people sort of step through it and go to another place?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how it worked?
Yep.
I guess the person in the chair who was in there, it was extremely important that they were the right person, that they
mm-hmm.
had the right skills, right?
Oh, sure. Well, once the vortex was open, it could be recorded, and then the computer would just adjust for the time on this end as time progressed. That's how they held the vortex open.
Wow. This computer sounds like something that most of us don't have access to. And this is a long time ago, and that must be much more powerful than anything we have today.
Yeah, it was a Cray 1 or a Cray 2.
Okay.
It was like 8 different Cray 1s or Cray 2s that were all like parallel processing.
And wow.
And even by today, it still would be a mini mainframe computer.
Yeah.
Although back then, it filled many, many rooms.
Yeah, the Cray did. Now, this people...
And there was 8 of them in use.
Wow. So this was back in 71, right?
Yeah.
And of course, if you look at Montauk, all you see from the pictures that we have on the CD is just a bunch of old buildings. You would say there's no way you could fit all those Crays in there, but I think you're saying that the Montauk base was underground.
Yes. It had 6 levels underground at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom 2 levels were huge. We rode around in golf carts in the bottom 2 levels.
Would you say how many, say, gymnasiums, high school gymnasiums size would it be?
Well, golf carts ran about 30 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
and the run from one end to the other end of the main corridor took about 15 minutes. So you're looking at miles here.
Yeah.
5-7 miles, I would guess.
How in the world do you make something like that?
A lot of digging.
Yes, I would say so. People say, I think this was originally an Army Corps of Engineer project,
mm-hmm.
back in the 20s, in the 40s.
The underground was originally built in the 40s. It was updated and enlarged in the early 50s. And then two more levels were added in the late 80s.
So there was,
now it's an 8-level underground.
8 levels. Wow. So were the levels below the six?
Mm-hmm.
So they must have had some fairly sophisticated equipment to do that.
I never saw it, but they must have.
Oh, yeah.
Every so often, a big door on the end of Montauk Point would open up, and this huge rectangular boulder would come down with a big, loud thud.
Mm.
I've seen, you know, friends of mine have seen it happen very early in the morning and at night.
Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never seen it. I've seen the boulders. You look at a lot of these boulders that were appearing in the late 80s, you wonder where the hell they come from.
Right.
They looked almost too big to be trucked in.
Maybe they were shipped in.
Well, when I saw the boulders appear off of Montauk Point as mm-hmm. part of the lighthouse reconstruction project, I made an effort for about 2 months asking around the locals, had anyone ever seen those boulders coming in on a truck or a barge? No. None of the fishermen had seen any barges, and none of the townspeople felt any trucks go by.
And they just appeared.
They just appeared. And then I found some town people who told me, you know, I was sitting at the point by the lighthouse,
mm-hmm.
and the ground rumbled, this door slid open, and this giant rectangular rock came out of the hole in the end of the cliff and that fell on the beach with a giant thud.
So are these boulders rectangular?
Mm-hmm.
At Montauk, at the lighthouse?
They were until they cut them up.
Ah.
Until they broke them up. When you go out there, you can still see the flat surfaces on some of the rocks.
They do have a flat surface.
Oh, yeah, nice flat surface.
Ah, that's interesting.
Like you cut it with a diamond saw.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And just all sorts of images come to my mind. So getting back to this chair, how many different people actually operated it? I'd call Duncan an operator.
I think there was 5 or 6 main people,
mm-hmm.
and they had many different people in it off and on. I wasn't involved with that, so I never knew the logistics of that.
But you actually saw it, though.
Oh, yeah. I saw the chair. I was involved in building the chair and designing it.
Okay. But not operating it.
Yeah, I was involved in operating it, but it was from a supervisory. I got called when they had troubles.
Okay.
When it didn't do something they wanted to do, I got called in.
Hmm. So for maintenance or something, right?
No, more for modifications.
Okay.
We had a very large maintenance crew out there.
How many people would you say were in this facility while you were working there?
Oh, 300, 200.
It's amazing. So there are probably people at AIL that you worked with that were doing the same thing you were doing.
Probably.
Huh.
I would say probably a third of the company was involved in the same way.
Wow. Now, I've heard, I guess reading around, that a lot of these Montauk boys got sent through this vortex that you're talking about and never returned.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate?
The Montauk boys, but they would basically send people through the vortex.
Okay, so like Duncan would create a vortex.
Mm-hmm.
They'd send a boy through.
Somebody. They'd send a guy through.
Okay.
Usually with cameras.
They
were lucky if he got back in the beginning.
Wow. What was the problem?
Stability of the vortex.
Mm-hmm. And so was that something you worked on to make that vortex more stable?
We all worked on that.
Mm-hmm. So how many people do you think were lost?
I don't have the foggiest, but a lot.
You think it was a lot?
I would say over 100.
Wow.
And actually, I don't know.
Sure. It's just a guess.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another guess I'm going to ask you. Where do you think those people are right now?
Who knows?
Wow.
Maybe out in space? I don't know.
Well, they wouldn't last too long there.
No, they wouldn't.
So you think they just died?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so eventually you got to the point where you were able to stabilize the vortex.
Yes, we did. I didn't think so until I recalled my own time travel experiences.
Let's get into that. Where did you go?
Well, from the 70s, I went into 1995 and was involved in fighting a forest fire, supposedly. It was a forest fire, but the fire was a cover for the crash of a 100-foot giant sphere, a crystalline sphere that crashed in the Fine Barrens here. I was part of a team where guys were brought in from different times to make up this recovery team.
Was that New York?
Mm-hmm. And the local news channel got footage of us. Through that footage, I recognized someone else that I know, and then that fellow and his friends recognized me.
Wow.
And it was, hey, Dad, come over here. Look at that. Who's that? He says, well, that's you from about 25 years ago.
Wow. So I would imagine that the recovery was successful?
Yeah, sure it was.
It was, what was this thing? It was a crystal?
It was a spherical, some sort of spacecraft.
Okay.
It went down in the Pine Barrens with a giant thud, about 100 foot in diameter.
And why was it necessary to take you from 71 or whatever to 95?
I don't know. I don't know what that logistics was.
Someone decided to do that.
Yep.
And then send you back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done any other time traveling?
Well, from the future to here, I have.
Ah.
But I don't recall anything else I did through the Montauk system. I recall telling him, I don't ever want to do that again. That was the scariest thing I'd ever done. You know, go through that double light cone portion that was made out there.
What did it make you sick, or?
Well, you'd be compressed to nothing.
Yeah.
You didn't exist, and then you'd be expanded back again.
What do you feel when that happens?
Feels like you're dying.
Ah. Is it painful?
It was, but it was very fast, the actual painful part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like a flash of pain.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it was the most scary thing I ever went through.
Like the most immense pain, just for a second, can be a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So it wasn't something you wanted to make a career out of?
No.
So do you recall anything about that vessel that you retrieved? Anything more than you did it?
Well, let's not go into that on this.
Okay, that's fine. You just tell me where to stop.
Hmm?
Well, you just tell me where to stop, and we'll stop at that point. Okay. Well, where next?
I don't know.
Did you ever come in any contact with extraterrestrials while you were at Montauk?
Yeah, sure.
You say that as a matter-of-fact, casual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which types were there?
About a 7-foot-tall reptilian creature and the grays. 5-foot grays and 3.5-foot grays.
Was this a 7-foot-tall reptilian creature? Was he the Draco that Al talks about?
Yes.
And how would you characterize him?
I wouldn't even attempt that.
Hmm.
Because I had very little to do with that creature, because that creature called me a Pleiad dog. Weren't very friendly.
Did he seem to run the thing, run the show?
Not that I could observe. I thought he was there as an observer of some sort.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't like you very much, huh?
No.
From what I understand, he didn't like too many people.
I think he loathed and despised me.
Wow.
He called me a Pleiad dog, which I now realize is a Pleiadian dog, you know, which is their arch enemy.
Ah. Well, Al says that, you know, he actually conversed with him, and they sort of got to a level of respect for each other.
That I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting side issue there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the grays, now there's two types, right? The tall and the shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say the function of the tall grays were?
Workers of some sort.
Oh, the tall ones were workers?
Yeah.
Because I've always understood the short ones were workers.
Both.
They're both workers.
They both were workers there.
And do you have any recall as to what their capacity was?
No, I don't.
Okay. You just saw them.
I just saw them.
It seems like, Preston, that everything was very compartmentalized.
Very.
I mean,
in fact, you had to literally fight to get any information on anything.
Mm-hmm.
I spent hours in the security office trying to justify that I should learn some other data. I needed other data.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was extremely compartmentalized.
So you were on a need-to-know basis, right?
Very need-to-know.
Mm-hmm. So someone could come up with a story that they worked at Montauk, and you would have never even known them, possibly.
Mm-hmm. So that, very possibly.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a big group. It was a big crew.
You know, as time goes on, I mean, you're right in the middle of this whole thing. Have you had a lot of people coming up to you and saying, you know, I worked there too?
Mm-hmm. I used to run into people at what we call HamFest.
Okay.
Which is amateur radio conventions and flea markets that would come up to me and say, you remember me? I look at them and say, I remember you. Well, we worked together on the Montauk Air Force Base. There was O.
Yeah.
And then my cousin married a guy who claimed that I was his boss at the Montauk Air Force Base. He was in the Air Force. And the whole family thought that guy was nuts. But now I do remember him.
Wow.
He did work for me.
How about that?
But I didn't know it at the time.
So what happened with him? I guess his programming didn't work correctly.
Well,
sounds like a lot of people.
My cousin divorced him after a lot of years, and mm-hmm. the family says he's somewhere around probably being as screwy as ever.
Yeah, that's going to be the
common. Family says that he was definitely a screwball.
Huh.
And I would always say to my aunt, well, that's the Montauk Project.
Yeah.
He worked at the Montauk Project.
Gosh, about how many people all these years have come up to you and said, you know, I remember you? Or
about 20 or 30.
20 or 30?
Yeah.
Well, that really leads a lot of credibility to this story.
And then when I started to remember two memory lines, that was real strange.
I would say it's very confusing. So
it made me doubt my sanity.
It would have to, yeah.
Although the only thing that kept me anchored was recollections of the number of people that came up to me and said that they remembered me from the Montauk base. That's the only thing that kept my sanity at all, or else I would have volunteered to go to the rubber room after that.
Huh. So you're going...
All of a sudden, recall you did two things for the same time period. That's, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Which one is false? So it turns out they're both accurate. They're both correct.
Wow.
Do 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 do.
Well, it's a great way for cheap labor, you know.
Yes, I know.
And you know, it must have just physically worn you out.
Yes.
So I mean, you'd be working two jobs. I mean, it's still the same you.
Well, instead of being 54 years of age. I'm probably more like 64 years of age in actuality. Yeah.
But were you physically tired that whole time period of 15 years?
Oh, yeah.
Run down?
No, I wouldn't say I was run down. I used to sleep out there. I'd go out there, work for 2 or 3 days a clip, and I had a room in the barracks to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did get enough rest.
Okay. Just, you're just...
I think traveling through the time device that they used on me to run me back a day, 2 days, 3 days, I think that was very fatiguing, that device.
Hmm.
I remember walking out of that room almost sick to my stomach.
Each time?
Yeah, each time.
Yeah. That would be my guess.
That, if anything, would tire me out.
Hmm. So what was the purpose of this Montauk Boys project, to your recollection?
It was a continuation of something called Monarch Project.
Monarch.
Which is, the basic idea is to take a young lad and basically split his mind, generate a split personality.
Mm-hmm.
Bury one side, have the other side be dominant, but on command, flip the personalities and make a secret, you know, hidden soldier.
So, I guess in 1 hour he could be your best friend, the next hour he's stabbing you in your back, and mm-hmm. he doesn't know the difference, right? So on command, he could turn just like that,
mm-hmm.
and would one side know what the other side is doing?
Not most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the memory is compartmentalized depending upon which personality it is. Well, it was basically generating multiple personality disorder,
mm-hmm.
and then using it.
So they would have some trigger, some mechanism that would actually invoke that other personality,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So would they implant commands, or how did they do that?
It varied.
Varied.
I would imagine everything from commands to pieces of music.
Mm-hmm.
One guy, you'd grab him and choke him, and he'd flip. You know, stuff like that. There was many different triggers.
Hmm. So, did the techniques over your 15 years become more and more refined?
Yeah, they did.
Right. Because Al says
it started out with literally beating the boy out of body, and then putting the mind on a supercomputer. And then using psychosexual means to reinsert the mind,
mm-hmm.
to basically evolving into a teleportation device where they had two buffers, a mind and a physical buffer, and they would teleport them but just store them in the buffer and then put the mind patterns into the computer and then put it back and reintegrate.
Now that was a mouthful right there.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying, see if I got you right, that they could actually pull the mind... Almost make a, like, I'm thinking of a computer. I have a file on a diskette.
Mm-hmm.
And
you said... One would be for the physical body and one would be for the non-physical mind.
Yeah, so they would sort of take that file off the diskette, do what they wanted to do, and then place it back onto the diskette, and that
and
file
then reintegrate
was,
the body.
Was their mind.
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing.
That's what it evolved to.
And
I still, to this day... don't know what kind of a computer they use for that. Because I don't think we even have a computer today capable of holding a human consciousness. But this machine had it.
No.
Al always thought it was an alien computer. All I know is a cryogenic computer. Because the door that went into the room that had the computer, and I never saw the door open and have a sign for cryogenics on it.
Yeah. Well, wasn't this computer ultimately destroyed by that monster?
No, it wasn't. I don't know what happened to the computer. I would assume that they removed it afterwards.
Mm.
But the Montauk Boys Project was moved out of Montauk around 1980.
Okay. Do you know where it got moved to?
It was moved to Rocky Point.
Rocky Point, where?
On Long Island.
Oh, on Long Island. Okay.
There was like a satellite Montauk project at Rocky Point in 1980, up to present day, I think. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. Now, there's a lot of discussion that it's really not in just one location. It's in many, many, many locations right now.
Yes, this is true. It was all over the world.
That means there's a lot of mind control slaves out there.
Yes, there is.
And they don't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Air Force figures there's a 5 million man army out there.
Ready on command.
Ready on command. And they don't have the foggiest idea who controls them.
The Air Force says this?
Mm-hmm. That's what they told me. Because in secret, the military is very concerned about the secret army. So maybe the military is going to fight them, and they don't know how many in the military are part of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
How many in the reserves are part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's unknown.
Well, someone knows.
If I say it's unknown in the governmental level.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but somebody knows, right? Now, have you ever gone beyond 1995? You said your future self came and did he pay you a visit?
Yeah, a couple of times.
And were you careful not to touch each other?
No.
You touched each other?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't blink out of existence?
No.
And what did you look like? What did your future self look like?
Thinner, more gray hair, older. Mm-hmm.
And you touched him, and nothing happened. Shake hands. What'd you do? Hugged each other?
No, we didn't hug.
I would have fallen on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I would have fallen on the floor, and he would have had to pick me up.
No, I didn't fall on the floor.
Wow. Why did your future self come to see you? Can you talk about that?
Basically, I guess to influence me to do certain things so that certain things go in certain ways in the future. I was actually taken into the future and shown certain things, which I'm best not talking about. I know you're going to next ask me, well, what do I know about the future? And I think
you're
I know
there.
A lot, but I'm not going to say anything.
Would you say that's a probable future, then?
Well, as long as I'm involved in a time loop, for me, it's not probable.
It's fixed for you. Now, that's important.
For me, it's fixed. Other things can vary that don't affect me. But anything that affects me, it's fixed.
So, well, now, the fact that I've talked to you, does that mean I'm linked to your future?
I don't know for sure. Possible.
It's just a guess. But you're pretty sure that your future is fixed.
So, mine is, yeah.
So what about Al Bielix then? Because he's been to, you know, 2137 and the 28th century. Are those futures fixed for him as well?
Sure.
Hmm.
Once you're part of a time loop, your future becomes fixed.
And how many time loops are there out there?
God knows. I don't.
Infinite, right?
Probably not infinite, but damn close to it.
Yeah. See, it's hard for the average person to grasp this, but you know, you have parallel universes. That discussion comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How many parallel universes are there? And if you go back in time, are you just creating a splinter in the timeline? So what really happened happened, but now you created something new. And any ideas?
Well, when you do something like that, you create alternate timelines.
Right. So is that a real thing in your mind? Now, it's interesting. You don't want to talk about the future. I'm not going to ask you about that. But is it because by doing so, does that make things worse?
I don't know. It's just that basically, I don't believe in talking that much about the future because I don't want to have that much influence on what happens.
Hmm.
Although I know for a fact I'm influencing what happens.
Yeah.
So, drastically.
So it's almost, you're saying, in a sense, we're creating our future, though.
Oh, yeah.
And by, let's just say it's something bad that happens, whatever it could be.
Not necessarily.
Well, if it was good, you'd want to influence it even more. But let's just...
Good. I wouldn't want to influence it to where it goes bad.
Yeah, right. But let's just say, you know, 20 years from now, something bad. Are you saying by talking about it and getting other people to buy into it, then it becomes more of a reality for them as well, and that's what you're trying to avoid?
Sure it does.
Okay, so in a sense, you're still saying we're creating our future.
To quite an extent, yes.
Mm-hmm. Gets very confusing, Preston.
No, it isn't.
For you, it's not. You lived it. Yeah, you lived it. Wow. Now, apparently there was an incident back in 83 when everything went to hell at Montauk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's when Duncan brought in this Sasquatch or Bigfoot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Were you on the base at that time?
Yes, I was.
You were there.
Yes, I was there. I saw the thing.
You saw it. What did he look like?
Look like a 9-foot Sasquatch.
Just your average run-of-the-mill 9-foot Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he do?
Tore things apart. Destroyed things.
Mm-hmm.
Took bites out of buildings, literally.
Bites out of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now he was.
If you get my videos, you'll see bite marks on some of the buildings.
Yeah, actually, now might be a good time. We'll get into that. You have several books that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what are the names of those books?
That's the Montauk Project, Experiments in Time.
Okay.
Montauk Project, Adventures in Synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
Montauk Project, Pyramids of Montauk. I wrote a book called Encounter in the Pleiades, which is my UFO book.
Okay.
And the new one is The Music of Time, which is my recollections of when I was in the music business, you know, recording rock and roll of the 60s and the very early 70s.
And you said you knew the Beatles at that time.
Yes, I knew the Beatles. I knew the Beatles, I knew the Rolling Stones, I knew the Doors, I knew the Turtles, I knew the Animals.
Was this an alternative reality for you, though?
No, this was in real time.
Real time. Wow.
It was a job I had.
Yeah, from what I understand, you were quite well-known, renowned for your skill in audio equipment.
Mm-hmm.
This is during the 60s, right?
Yes.
Wow. So you knew all the big guys.
Yeah, I knew the big guys.
Wow. And you said you have a video for sale, too, right?
Yes, I have two videos. Montauk Tour, which is a tour of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And I have Montauk Tour number 2, which is a review of radio songs. I show the Tesla receivers. I show the national radio receiver that came from John von Neumann, which is based on the Tesla design. That there's some time legends about that set. So, and I show Al's house, where he and his friend Pete had some sort of solitonic electromagnetic field that you step about 2 foot outside of the house, the signal disappeared.
Hmm.
And then I show full scope traces of the harp signal. And then I show full scope and spectrum displays of the blips and blurps and bleeps at Montauk in the early 90s.
Wow. And if people are interested in this tape, how do they get a hold of it?
You can order it right through Sky Books.
Through Sky Books. Do they have a website?
Yeah, I think it's Sky Books at Yahoo.
Okay.
But if you do a search on Sky Books, you'll find it.
I'll tell you what I'll do for you is on this CD, I'll put a hyperlink to Sky Books. So people listening to this, go back to your CD, you'll see the page.
Right.
that hyperlinks you so that you can get all of Preston Nichols' information and order the books.
That's one of the reasons I do these interviews, is to help push the book.
Sure. It helps everybody out by doing these things. And again, we really appreciate it. What am I missing here in this story?
I don't know.
How about when you first met Al in 1983? Is that when you said you met him as in this reality?
Yeah.
Which is strange. 83, that's when, you know, that's when he supposedly landed in Montauk, 1983.
That was as Ed Cameron.
Right.
I met him as Al Bielek.
Okay.
You know, about 17 years younger than he is today.
and where was this show held?
I believe it was in Portland, Oregon.
All the way out there?
Yeah.
Wow. And weren't you with Duncan at the time?
No, this was before I met Duncan.
Okay.
2 years later, in Ohio, Duncan and I came out. He and I built a big Tesla coil at the Psychotronics Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Al first met Duncan in this timeline.
And what was what was it like when they met each other?
Well, when they first met, they hit it right off. They gravitated to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They got along very well. Then, as the years progressed, there became some sort of friction between Duncan and Al from Duncan's end.
Hmm.
And Duncan kept reading that Al is a physical relative of his. And at that time, he didn't like Al at all.
And when you said reading, you're talking about intuitively reading.
Yeah, psychic reading.
Psychic reading, okay. He didn't like Al.
First we're trying to figure was Al an uncle. It finally came up that Al was Duncan's half-brother.
So how
and
did
Duncan found that real nauseating.
Wow.
Which means that adds more validity to Duncan's read, because that's the last thing he wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And then we came up with Al's involvement in the Philadelphia experiment.
Mm-hmm.
First, Duncan came up with his involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, my brother Ed was also involved. And we decided not to tell Al until he recalled it himself. And as Al himself says, he called me up one day and said, Preston, I was involved in the Philadelphia experiment. And I said back to him, yes, I know, Al. We've known this for the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted you to remember it.
And
I sent him little bits and pieces to make him look at this.
Mm-hmm.
So he would recall it.
How did it go with Duncan from liking Al in the beginning to disliking him?
I don't know for sure. I think subconsciously Duncan looked at Al as almost like a relative that abused him.
Hmm.
And it may relate back to the work that Al and Duncan did at Montauk, which was history at that time.
Sure was, yeah.
And, you know, Al may have had Duncan doing things that were not too pleasant for him, and he tied Al to that.
Mm.
You know, the unpleasant times.
And he probably remembered all that. Does Duncan remember a lot of what happened at Montauk?
He remembers more than he likes to say.
Okay. He just wants to let the past be the past.
Yeah.
Which I can understand. Hmm. Wow. So, you know, if you're sitting back, and let's just say somebody off the street listens to this, what's the message in all this for these people?
I don't know.
Is there a message?
Message is that there's a lot more going on out there. Hang on a sec.
Mm-hmm.
How much time is left on the tape?
For me?
Okay. 19. It means at 8:20 I'll have to go turn off my tape machine.
Oh, are you taping this?
No.
Okay.
Actually, about 10 minutes.
Okay.
So we are either, you'll have to wait probably a few minutes until I get in to stop the tape machines. I'm making copies of the Montauk tour tapes right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta go eventually shut the machines off. How much more do you want to talk of?
Well, I think we're almost at the end. Unless there's something that I'm missing. I mean, I didn't experience it. I'm trying to piece it all together. And we're just really getting into, is there really any message for anybody here? And certainly that would be hard to answer, but...
Well, the message would be that there's a lot more going on out there than anyone thinks. And mm-hmm. keep your ear to the ground and, you know, dig into things. That's the only way we stay free.
So,
but this whole project was basically to deprive us of our freedom. That was one of the goals of this work.
Would you
the
say...
The message is to keep digging into things and keep the government honest.
Would you say they succeeded?
By an extent.
Mm-hmm.
We're not as free as we were today, as we were back, you know, 20 years ago. We've lost a lot of our freedoms.
I think most people would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So your message is, keep digging, don't believe the first thing you see or hear.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is going to, you know, startle a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay, I think.
That's the only way we'll stay free.
Right.
Is for the public to question the government,
mm-hmm.
which I'm very happy to see that the public in general is questioning the government.
More and more.
More and more.
But not enough, in my own mind.
I think there's only a handful of people today that trust the government.
And those are the ones in it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones who are in the government.
Not even them.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well,
can you tilt that light there? That's good. Huh?
Preston, I think we got what we needed to get out of this.
Okay.
Interview. I appreciate it.
Okay.
It's going to help out, and good luck, and I certainly encourage everyone to go visit Preston's website area and get some of his books.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.